Good morning.
Good morning.
Hope you had a good Christmas. Yeah. God provides before the need is known. There was a small town that had a church and a whiskey distillery. Members of the church complained that the distillery gave the community a bad image. On top of this, the owner of the distillery was an atheist. They tried to shut down the place but were unsuccessful. Saturday night came and a terrible electrical storm raged. To the delight of the church members, lightning struck the distillery and it burned to the ground. Next morning, the sermon in the church was on the providence of God. Fire insurance adjusters promptly notified the distillery owner. They will not pay for his damages. The fire was caused by an act of God, they said, and coverage for acts of God was excluded in the policy. Whereupon the distillery owner sued all the church members, claiming that their God had destroyed his building. The defendants denied absolutely that God had done anything to cause the fire. The trial judge observed, "I find one thing about this case that is very perplexing. We have a situation where the plaintiff, an atheist, is professing his belief in the providence of God, and the defendant's church members are denying the providence of God." This illustration shows that it is one thing to perceive God's providence, it is another to believe in it. These two principles, balanced throughout the entire book of Esther, serve as our focus in these opening chapters and introduction. God is present and is providentially working through everyday events, protecting and providing for his people. The story of Esther was played out in Susa, the capital and palace of the fourth king of Persia. It is a story of God's care for his people, the Jews, the majority of which did not make the journey back to Israel and did not seem concerned for God's theocratic program centered in the land of promise, around the law of Moses, and upon the Levitical system of sacrifice and worship. Why would God show such concern for those who seemed to show so little? Because he had made a promise to provide a deliverer, and because what was about to happen in Susa would threaten that promise. The nation was about to be massacred, but God was at work in Susa, as well as in Jerusalem, to preserve his people and safeguard his promise. Though we'll find many interesting characters mentioned in this story, the important actor is undisclosed in print. His name appears nowhere in the book of Esther, but his fingerprints are everywhere. His providence directed every event. He accomplished his purpose in a pagan land as well as in the promised land. This lesson today studies a time when God's providence was at work before a need was humanly known. What on the surface seemed to be a husband-wife disagreement by a pagan king and his queen was really the hand of God at work. God is at work keeping his promises even when his name is not mentioned. Let us first look at Roman numeral 1, the story. The story. We have letter A, a defiant queen. A defiant queen in Esther chapter 1 verses 1 to 22. And there was number 1, a 6-month festival. A 6-month festival. Esther chapter 1 verses 1 to 4 says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace, in the 3rd year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media. the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him, when he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty many days, even 180 days. As the story opens, we find ourselves in the city of Susa, at the winter palace of Ahasuerus, the king of Persia. He is also known by his Greek name, Xerxes. His empire stretched from India, equivalent to the province of Punjab in Pakistan today, to Ethiopia or Kush, encompassing 127 provinces. A foundation tablet was discovered at Persepolis. It reads, "Thus speaks King Xerxes, these are the countries, in addition to Persia, over which I am king, under the shadow of Ahura Mazda, India, and Kush." When we attempt to do too many things at once, we often get rattled and accomplish even less. The story is told of young Charles Darwin, in Great Lives, Great Deeds, that one day he was eagerly holding one rare beetle in his right fist, another in his left, and then suddenly he caught sight of a third beetle, which he simply knew he must have for his collection. What to do? In a flash, he put one of the beetles in his mouth for safekeeping and reached for the third beetle with his now free hand. But the mouth-imprisoned beetle squirted acid down young Darwin's throat, so that in a fit of coughing, he lost all three beetles. Darwin's greed led him to squander his beetles. Similarly, Ahasuerus' greed led him to squander his power and wealth. The year was 482 BC, the third year of Ahasuerus' reign. The king was preparing to wage a military campaign against Greece, greedy to expand his empire and seeking revenge for defeats his father had suffered at the hand of the Athenians at the Battle of Marathon in 490 BC. In preparation for this campaign, he called together all the nobility and leaders of his vast kingdom. During the festivities, which lasted 180 days, Xerxes displayed the splendor and opulence of his great empire as he prepared battle plans. We are impressed by Ahasuerus' power and wealth, but the way he squandered them for his own appetite and pleasure is unsavory. Daniel had rightly prophesied concerning the great wealth and military plans of this fourth king of Persia. Daniel chapter 11 verse 2 says, "And now will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia." Not only was there a 6-month festival, there was, number two, a 7-day feast. A 7-day feast. At the end of the 6-month festival, Xerxes held a 7-day feast. Esther chapter 1 verse 5 says, "And when these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan the palace, both unto great and small, 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace." The term used for feast could literally be translated a drinking feast. The law neither compelled people to drink nor restrained them from drinking. Esther chapter 1 verse 8 says, "And the drinking was according to the law, none did compel. For so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house that they should do according to every man's pleasure. The royal wine also flowed in abundance." The historian Herodotus noted that the Persians were extremely fond of wine and drank it in large amounts, especially when deliberating on important matters. Ridiculous. How could they deliberate on important matters when they were drunk? Let me give another example. It seems this particular fellow frequently came home drunk, and he was so far gone that he would fall into bed fully clothed, pass out, and then snore loudly all night long. His wife was losing so much sleep because of his snoring. One night, her husband came in as usual, fell across the bed fully dressed, passed out, and started snoring. The wife got up, pulled a blue ribbon from her dresser, and tied it around his nose. The snoring stopped. Next morning, the wife, fully refreshed, was preparing breakfast and asked her husband as he was awakening, "Honey, where were you last night?" The husband, still fully clothed, looked in the mirror and, seeing the blue ribbon around his nose, replied, "I don't know, but wherever I was, I won first prize." How could the Persians deliberate on important matters when they were drunk? While Persian queens usually ate at the king's table, they do not do so during times of great festivals. So while the king held his bash for the men in the house of the garden, the queen staged a feast for the women inside the king's house. Esther chapter 1 verse 9 says, "Also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus." There was a 6-month festival. There was a 7-day feast. There was also, number 3, a husband-wife fight. A husband-wife fight. Here is an example of a husband-wife fight. Husband to wife. How can someone so beautiful be so stupid? Wife to husband. "God made me beautiful so you would marry me. He made me stupid so I would marry you." Marriage is like twirling a baton, turning handsprings, or eating with chopsticks. It looks easy until you try it. The stage was set for a major marital conflict, the first of several conflicts that served to set the stage for God's climactic deliverance of his people. Toward the end of the calendar year, a young pastor's wife was sharing her aspirations with the congregation. Her somewhat ambitious goal had been to visit every lady in the congregation before the year ended. Apologizing for failing to reach her lofty goal, the pastor's wife asked anyone who desired such a visit before the end of the year to please raise their hands. One lone person raised his hand, the pastor. Ahasuerus desired a visit from his wife too. The king communicated with his harem through his band of eunuchs. As the 7-day celebration drew to an end, Ahasuerus instructed those messengers to summon his queen Vashti. He desired to parade her before his drunken companions as just another display of the splendor of his kingdom. Esther chapter 1 verses 10 to 11 says, "On the 7th day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Bista, Habona, Bigtha, and Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcass, the 7 chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on." The queen wisely rejected this invitation. Much like Islamic law today, Persian law forbade women to be seen unveiled by strangers. And certainly a garden full of drunken men was not the audience with which to begin a new custom. Vashti regarded her reputation and integrity of higher value than a lofty position. She was willing to pay whatever price the king would exact. The king, infuriated by the queen's refusal, sought counsel concerning the proper course of action. The description of his counselors as wise men, which knew the times, in Esther chapter 1 verse 13, clearly indicates that they were astrologers and magi. In addition to being men who knew the customs and laws of Persia, These royal advisors serve as the king's closest associates and counselors. The advisors were concerned, for the queen's conduct could become public knowledge. The possibility existed that women throughout that male-dominated kingdom, including the wives of those seven counselors, might emulate her defiance. Memucan, speaking on behalf of the others, offered a solution to solve both the private and potentially public problem in Esther chapter 1, verses 16 to 20. The proposal had two parts. The only response by the king was to have Vashti removed and replaced as queen, and to publish a decree that all wives were to give honor to their husbands, for husbands were to rule their homes. Esther chapter 1, verses 19 to 20 says, "If it please the king, let there go a royal commandment from him, and let it be written among the laws of the Persians and the Medes, that it be not altered, that Vashti come no more before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal estate unto another that is better than she. And when the king's decree which he shall make shall be published throughout all his empire, for it is great, all the wives that give shall give to their husbands honor, both the great and small." Ole and Olga live on a farm in Iowa. Olga was living on a starvation diet of affection. Ole never gave her any signs of love, and Olga's need to be appreciated went unfulfilled. At her wit's end, Olga blurted out, "Ole, why don't you ever tell me that you love me?" Ole stoically responded, "Olga, when we were married, I told you that I loved you. And if I ever change my mind, I'll let you know." The king changed his mind. Pleased with the council, the king made the decree. Agatha Christie once said, "An archaeologist is the best husband a wife can have. The older she gets, the more interesting she is." Ahasuerus did not value his wife, not because she was too young, but because she was defiant. According to the unalterable nature of Persian law, as shown in Esther chapter 8, verse 8, and Daniel chapter 6, verses 8, 12, and 15, the king's words were sealed and sent via an ancient pony express system throughout the entire empire. By the way, what happens when you merge FedEx and UPS? You get Fed Up Express. Esther chapter 1, verse 22 says, "For he sent letters unto all the king's provinces, into every province according to the writings thereof, and to every people after their language, that every man should bear rule in his own house, and that it should be published according to the language of every people." Translated as necessary, it was delivered in every language represented in the kingdom. While we have a defiant queen in Esther chapter 1, we have in Esther chapter 2, letter B, a diligent quest. A diligent quest. In Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. Esther chapter 2, verses 1 to 4 says, "After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Then said the king's servants that ministered unto him, let there be fair young virgins sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom, that they may gather together all the fair young virgins unto Shushan, the palace, to the house of the women under the custody of Hegi, the king's chamberlain, keeper of the women, and let their things for purification be given them, and let the maiden which pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." And the thing pleased the king, and he did so. The phrase that introduces the second chapter, After these things, he remembered, encompasses a period of 4 years. From the time of Vashti's demotion in the 3rd year of the king's reign until the promotion of Esther in the 7th year. Esther chapter 2 verse 16. During this gap of time, Ahasuerus waged war with Greece. He had spent his first 4 years building his tremendous war machine, and the next 2 engaged in conflict with the West. The military campaign that began in the spring of 481 BC concluded with some staggering losses in 479 BC. His vast army and navy had been humiliated. Demoralized and depressed for failing to avenge his father's defeats and expand his empire, the king began to recall with affection his former queen and the companionship she had provided. A boy's first dilemma is when he determines that he likes girls better than he likes frogs and dogs, but he doesn't know why. Ahasuerus' dilemma was when he determined that he liked his former queen, that he liked war, but he didn't know why. In an effort to bolster the king's fallen spirit, his servants proposed that a search for a new queen begin at once. But they recommended a unique plan. Instead of selecting a queen from a small pool of nobility, as was the custom, the king would choose from beautiful women from throughout the empire. The woman would be taken to Susa and placed in the king's harem. Ahasuerus could then choose his new queen. With the king's overwhelming approval, a kingdom-wide contest was put into motion. Whom would he choose from among all the women of the kingdom? Who would win against such great odds? This brings us to letter C, a delightful queen. A delightful queen. In Esther chapter 2, verses 5 to 20. Esther chapter 2, verse 5 marks a distinct transition in this opening section. Scene 2 of Act 1 moves us from the palace of the king to a Jewish home in the kingdom. Here we are introduced to 2 major actors whom God used to deliver his people. Thus we have number 1, Esther's life in the home of Mordecai. Esther's life in the home of Mordecai. Esther chapter 2 verses 5 to 7 says, "Now in Shushan, the palace, there was a certain Jew, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which had been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. And he brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. And the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter." In Esther chapter 2 verses 5 to 7, we meet the human hero and heroine, Mordecai and Esther. The account describes Mordecai as living in the palace of Susa, probably intimating some position in the government of Persia. Esther chapter 2 verse 19 has him sitting in the king's gate, indicating that he held the position of a minor official. Mordecai had taken the responsibility of raising his younger cousin Esther after her parents died. Her name is derived either from the Persian word for star, starer, or from Ishtar, the Babylonian goddess of love. Her Hebrew name, Hadassah, means myrtle, a beautiful fragrance. Mordecai's name is derived from the Babylonian god Marduk. Historical evidence in a cuneiform tablet identifies a certain Marduka as a high official at the court of Susa during the early years of Xerxes. In this document, he appears as the trusted accountant of a well-known satrap of the Babylonian region. It is possible that this person was the Mordecai of this story, giving further evidence of the historicity of the book of Esther. It has been said that a woman needs four men in her life: a banker, an actor, a minister, and a mortician. One for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go. Esther only needed three men in her life: Mordecai, whom we talked about just now, Hegai, and Ahasuerus. Thus, not only do we have Esther's life in the home of Mordecai, we have, number two, Esther's life in the harem of Hegai. Esther's life in the harem of Hegai. Esther chapter 2 verse 8 says, "So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, to the custody of Hegai, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house, to the custody of Hegai, keeper of the women." Although the text gives no particular count for the number of women chosen to be finalists in this contest for queen, the historian Josephus stated that 400 women were chosen. These women were taken to the palace complex and placed in the house of women under the care of Hegai. One of those 400 finalists, against all human odds, was an orphaned Jewish girl named Esther. She immediately found favor with Hegai, who gave her preferential treatment, including the best accommodations in the house. Esther chapter 2 verse 9 says, "And the maiden pleased him, and she obtained kindness of him, and he speedily gave her her things for purification, with such things as belonged to her, and seven maidens, which were meet to be given her out of the king's house. And he preferred her and her maids unto the best place of the house of the women." God provided a friend for Esther in the form of Hegai. He filled Hegai's heart with goodwill towards her at first sight. During Esther's time in the harem, while she waited her turn to meet the king, Mordecai visited Esther frequently. "I'm sorry, Uncle Rudy. I don't know why the people in these drawings often don't have much hair." Esther chapter 2 verse 11 says, "And Mordecai walked every day before the court of the woman's house to know how Esther did and what should become of her." His access to the house of women and his status as a single man may indicate that Mordecai was a eunuch. He also counseled Esther not to reveal her nationality. Esther chapter 2 verse 10 says, "Esther had not showed her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it." Why he did so is not easily determined. He probably feared for safety, and possibly, due to his position as an official in the kingdom, he saw a growing anti-Semitism that forewarned of an imminent threat to and foreboding future for the Jewish people. He hoped that in some way, Esther's circumstances might serve to assist her people at an opportune time. Esther chapter 4 verse 14. But by keeping her nationality a secret, partaking of the unclean foods of the house of women, and competing for the opportunity to marry a Gentile king, Esther compromised her faith, apparently without conflict. Though Esther and Mordecai eventually showed great courage and displayed national commitment to the point of willingly risking their lives, little evidence exists to indicate a commitment to the Lord God of Israel. Prayer was absent. They neglected scripture. They violated the covenant. Though we can applaud their moral courage, we must acknowledge their apparent infidelity to the covenant. That acknowledgement serves to highlight the true hero of the story, God Himself. He acted to deliver his people, not based on their performance, but solely upon his promise. Though his people failed to keep the covenant, he did not. He provided deliverance. We learn that in spite of man's failures, God can use them to fulfill his purpose for his own glory and honor. By the way, should this encourage us to be callous and do what is right in our own eyes, believing that God can still use us? Nothing of the kind. We must live according to God's word. Whether he uses us or not, and no matter what, is his prerogative. But we can be sure that we will bear the penalty and consequences of sins. We have Esther's life in the home of Mordecai. We have Esther's life in the harem of Haggai. We also have, number three, Esther's life in the house of Ahasuerus. Esther's life in the house of Ahasuerus. When it was Esther's turn to go and visit the king, Esther chapter 2 verse 15 says that she required nothing but what Haggai the king's chamberlain appointed. Esther's tastes and habits were simple, and her simple tastes indicate that she was not a pretender playing the game and putting on the face. Armed with natural beauty that exceeded all the others, and assisted by the counsel of Haggai, Esther made her entrance. If not pleased, the king could send her to join the rest of his concubines under the authority of Shaashgaz, where she might never have been called upon again. Esther chapter 2 verse 14. Esther chapter 2 verses 17 to 20 says, "And the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight, more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast unto all his princes and his servants, even Esther's feast, and he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. And when the virgins were gathered together the second time, then Mordecai sat in the king's gate. Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai had charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him." An excited 5-year-old reported to his parents about what he had learned in Sunday school. He told the story of Adam and Eve, and how Eve was created from one of Adam's ribs. A few days later, he told his mother, "My side hurts. I think I'm having a wife." King Ahasuerus was having a wife, and his side didn't hurt. King Ahasuerus, like the others in his palace, was struck by Esther's beauty. He chose her as his new queen and called for a great feast to make the announcement and celebrate her appointment. A king who had been very unhappy in marriage married a second time. His conduct was a triumph of hope vis-a-vis the defeat in war. The king believed Esther was his choice, but the eye of faith sees that she was God's choice. Though the king did not know her identity, God knew it. Esther's history may seem like a simple Cinderella story, an orphaned immigrant, descendant of slaves, becomes queen of the most powerful empire in the world. And as exciting as that history may be, the book of Esther is much more than that. It is a story of God's promises, which never fail, and of his providence, which will accomplish his promises. It is the account of the reversal of expectations. Vashti, the queen of nobility, was demoted. Esther, the orphan of servility, was elevated. So not only do we have the story, we have Roman numeral 2, the providence. The providence. Esther chapter 1 verse 1 to chapter 2 verse 20 does not mention the name of God. God was nowhere to be found. But that did not mean that he was not seeing and working. As we learn in the weeks that follow, God was present in Esther chapter 1 verse 1 to chapter 2 verse 20, working out his plans. The providence of God is seen in every step of the progress of Esther to a destined elevation. Ahasuerus' order to Vashti to appear before him in a company of drunken male guests is unimaginable. The same applies to Vashti's uncompromising stand and her preparedness to face the dire consequences. In both these situations, each of them could have acted and responded differently. Ahasuerus could have decided not to summon Vashti, and all this wouldn't have happened. Or Vashti could have just acceded to the king's summon and showed off her beauty, and all this wouldn't have happened. The fact of the matter is that God was working through the foolishness of Ahasuerus and the reaction of Vashti. As for Esther's appearance before and subsequent selection by the king, A. Carson had this to say: notwithstanding her incomparable beauty, it was possible that the king's affection might have been anticipated by some of those who had previous access, or from caprice or peculiarity of taste, he might have preferred another. But the providence of God had ordered this also, and no one pleased the king before the approach of the lovely Esther, and she obtained instant preference. Notwithstanding incomparable beauty, it was possible that the king's affection might have been anticipated by some of those who had previous access. In other words, Esther could have been married, and all this wouldn't have happened. Or from caprice or peculiarity of taste, he might have preferred another. In other words, Hegai could have sent someone else to Ahasuerus first, and Ahasuerus could have chosen that someone else as queen. But the providence of God had ordered this also, and no one pleased the king before the approach of the lovely Esther, and she obtained instant preference. Conclusion. Just as God led in Esther's life, he leads in ours today. We know that nothing happens to us without his knowledge and permission. Not only that, ultimately, all things that happen to us are for his glory. Revelation chapter 4 verse 11. My dear friends, may the fact that God's providence is clearly seen in Esther's life be an encouragement to us. The one who directed her life also directs your life and mine. Romans chapter 8 verses 28 to 39, which we read two lessons ago, assures the believer that God will accomplish his purposes and fulfill his promises. These verses present at least the following reasons for the believer to have hope in God. Verse 28, and we know, knowledge gained by spiritual perception. Verse 28, all things work together for good, God's ultimate good. Verses 29 and 30, for whom he did foreknow, them he also glorified. He has fully provided for us. Verse 31, if God be for us, there is no one greater. John Newton said, if the Lord be with us, we have no cause of fear. His eye is upon us, his arm over us, his ear open to our prayer, his grace is sufficient, his promise unchangeable. Verse 35, who shall separate us from the love of Christ? No one and no thing. He will protect and provide for his people. We need to have the eyes of faith to see him, and a heart of faith to believe in him as he works in our lives. His desire is to perfect us. We need to be perceptive, Hebrews 11:27, to be patient, James 1:3-4, and to persevere, Philippians 1:6. One night, a burglar entered the home of a Christian couple and their baby. As the burglar moved about the house, the baby began to move and showed signs of awakening. The burglar, fearing that the baby might awaken and cry and thus betray his presence, gently lifted the sleeping infant from the crib and placed him just outside the front door. Shortly after, the baby woke and began to cry. His crying awakened the father and mother. They ran in the direction where the crying came from. Just as they ran out the front door, the roof, which had been overloaded with a thick layer of snow, collapsed. Later, the burglar was found dead underneath the ruins near the things he had stolen. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them who are called according to his purpose. Romans chapter 8, verse 28. God provides before the need is known. Let's pray.